It's the story of a movement that sought to construct what Reverend John Dietrich called a religion without God, shifting the focus of religious faith from divinity to humanity. Clergy and journalists, philosophers and scientists banded together, refusing to believe that human beings could not be saved, and insisting that they themselves would be the instrument of their own salvation. These words, which come from the book Making the Manifesto, belong to the Reverend Bill Schultz, who, at 23, and the youngest signer of the second Humanist Manifesto, which was created in 1973. Bill went on to become the president of the Unitarian Universalist Society and the executive director of Amnesty International after that. And then after that, just recently this year, he became the executive director of the Unitarian Service Committee. And in 2000, he was awarded Humanist of the Year by the American Humanist Association. So I want to begin our story today with Bill, because his story encapsulates the time in history when religious humanism emerged and transformed through the 20th century. And then we'll have some sort of basis on which to evaluate if religious humanism is able to respond to the needs of the 21st century. So Bill was raised third-generation Unitarian. He calls his parents old-world Unitarians. His mother and he prayed every night together before he went to sleep. His father believed that he would be reunited with his parents and other deceased family members in something resembling heaven. His parents were a product of a time when everyone went to church. There wasn't really a choice of going or not, only the choice of which church do you go to. North America was almost entirely Christian. Almost everyone believed in God and heaven and prayed to a God who was believed to be supernatural, meaning a God that could change or transcend the rules of nature. This was the culture, the norm, the air everyone breathed. Then, at the end of the 19th century, there were two major developments. One was the emergence of science as a basis for factual understanding of the world. And the other was the acceptance of evolution as a valid explanation for how our world came into being and developed. Both of these developments challenged the belief in a supernatural God. Men and women of intelligence and reason grappled with the introduction of scientific knowledge and evolution. They arrived at two ways to understand evolution. Evolution, as I just mentioned, as a natural process that creates growth and change. And the other may have accepted the former, but then added that evolution was proof then that God existed. Religious humanism grew out of the former, a natural process without God. Modern Protestantism grew out of the latter. So here we have the fork in the road being evolution with and without God. Now, at the same time, there were other influences building in the culture. New ideas coming from biblical studies, psychology, and anthropology that were challenging the belief in an all-seeing, all-knowing, supernatural God. One, in 1835, there was a German theologian, David Friedrich, who published The Life of Jesus. Here he sought to look at the Bible in a pragmatic and historical way, understanding miracles in naturalistic and symbolic ways, which discouraged literal interpretations. A few years later, 1855, another German, a philosopher by the name of Ludwig Feuerbach, published The Essence of Christianity, which attempted to understand divinity as a projection of the human being's most primitive needs and desires and fears. This set the stage for Freud's challenge 50 years later in The Future of an Illusion, that God was little more than a projection of our human fears and wishes. And lastly, in 1890, there was a Scottish anthropologist, James Fraser, who wrote a book called The Golden Bough, which studied folklore and magic and rituals and showed the similarities between beliefs and rituals in early cultures and Christianity. Science, evolution, critical biblical studies, philosophy, psychology, anthropology together set the stage for a new religious movement, a paradigm shift, to use a modern description. So this was about the time that Bill Schultz's parents were born, somewhere between World War I and World War II. At this time, there were a number of Unitary ministers who, quite separately at first, were beginning to preach and write about how the influences of evolution and science, psychology and anthropology, affected religion. There was Charles Potter, who had left the Baptist to become a Unitarian and took up, as I mentioned earlier, his first church in Edmonton, Alberta, which was in 1914. One of the Edmonton members went up to him one day and said, "Listen, I've heard of a man down in Portland, a guy by the name of John Dietrich, who calls himself a humanist." One of the first times that word had been coined. Well, John Dietrich is considered the father of religious humanism. Dietrich came from the Reformed Church, but he was greatly influenced by one of his wealthy employers who was a member of the All Souls Unitarian Church in New York City. And through that influence, he became a Unitarian. When he arrived at the Portland Church, there were 60 members. 6 years later, they were up to 1,500. That's right, 1,500 people came out to hear him speak on this new religion that emphasized reason over belief and addressed challenging issues like evolution and science and upheld the intelligence and the creativity of humankind. Dietrich had caught the attention of people who were wanting to understand their world in a new and different way. As he studied and preached, his own thoughts were transformed. For example, he lectured on comparative religions, and as a result, he began to question even his liberal view of Jesus as the greatest spiritual leader of all history. He came to believe that the world owed a great debt to Buddha, Confucius, the Hebrew prophets, and the Greek philosophers. He accepted the scientific method as the most effective means for arriving at the truth. And he began to refer to prayer as aspiration. And he introduced secular readings into his worship services. Then Dietrich moved on to Minneapolis, where from 1916 to 1957, through lectures in the pulpit and over the radio and through his publications, he built a large and vibrant national following. So here is a man who caught the wave of new information and wrote it, meeting the needs of the population. And much of Dietrich's thoughts show up in the first Humanist Manifesto, which was signed in 1933. It was a time of hunger among the educated, left-leaning Americans, a time of American idealism, despite the Depression and the stock market crash, the drought and the stirrings in Europe. Dietrich, Potter, John Dewey, and Roy Wood Sellers, who was the principal author of that first manifesto and a Canadian from Ontario. So here were some of the early Unitarians who gathered together in 1933 to sign that first Humanist Manifesto. There were 36 signers in all of them men, 15 of them Unitarian ministers. I'd like you to listen to the words used in the preamble to the first manifesto.
There is a great danger of a final, and we believe fatal, identification of the word religion with doctrines and methods which have lost their significance and which are powerless to solve the problem of human living in the 20th century. Today, man's larger understanding of the universe, his scientific achievements, and his deeper appreciation of brotherhood have created a situation which requires a new statement of the means and purposes of religion. Such a vital, fearless, and frank religion, capable of furnishing adequate social goals and personal satisfactions, may appear to many people as a complete break with the past.
You can hear in these words the energy and the excitement of the time.
Human fulfillment is in the here and now.
They were taking their belief from the strength of science and human endeavor and forging a new religion for a new and brave world.
Religion must work increasingly for the joy of living.
The creators of this first manifesto believed they were at the forefront of something enormous, something tremendous, no less than the birth of a whole new religion.
The goal of humanism is to create a free and universal society in which people voluntarily and intellectually cooperate for the common good. Humanists demand a shared life in a shared world.
Thank you. And of course, there were criticisms of this first manifesto. It was human-centric, meaning that the human being had replaced God at the center of the universe. There was no mention of nature. It was only man's ingenuity that was going to save the world, not God. Unfortunately, the human evils of World War II took the air out of that joyous bubble of optimism surrounding that first manifesto. There was also nothing in the humanist philosophy that could give comfort at times of tragedy or suffering or death. And this, too, was made acutely clear because of the horrors of the Second World War. Reason, another critique, was the only trustable way to truth. Reason, the only defendable reality. There was no mention of church, no use of reverential language. It ignored the heart, feelings, the arts, the imagination, and didn't recognize the unknown mysteries. And as I already said, it was entirely male-centric. There was no mention of women. Well, 50 years later, those who wrote the Second Manifesto, they did try to correct some of these critiques. Brotherhood was changed to include women and feminism, and human interdependence with nature was included as well. And there was also a theological shift between that first and second manifesto, a change in how one lives religiously, a shift from believing to knowing. In the first manifesto, there was no talk of that direct experience of religious life. At that time, the words were religious belief. So today, Unitarians, I would suggest almost universally, consider direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder to be the most important source of our religious conviction. In his book, Religious Humanism in the 21st Century, Reverend William Murray says that although the Second Manifesto was, quote, more open and described a less dogmatic humanism, it did not do justice to the religious and the spiritual dimension, and nor did it provide an adequate understanding of human evil or the role of emotions. So the story of religious humanism continued to change, as it continues to change today. The edges from which those first passionate and revolutionary thinkers pushed are almost commonplace today. The basic tenets of humanism are now predominantly secular. There is a basic respect for all human beings. Immortality is found in how we live our lives now. Wisdom is found in all religions and cultures, and we each have the power in ourselves to live through the best that we are capable of living. We are responsible for what we do and become, and our lives are in our own hands. But if many of the tenets of humanism are integrated in the secular society, what's left for the future of humanism? I turn back to the Reverend Bill Murray, who says that the religion of the 21st century has five characteristics. Number one, it must affirm that human beings are an integral part of nature. Number two, it will affirm humankind's responsibility to preserve and sustain the natural world. Three, it will take seriously the implications for religion of the remarkable discoveries of the natural and human sciences. Four, it will recognize the importance of both reason and reverence. And finally, the religion of the future must affirm those values that help us make our lives more fully human. We have moved into a time in history when we experience the interconnectedness of life, not just supported by belief or philosophy, but backed up by hard scientific fact and experience through our intuition and our reason. Today, religious humanism understands and celebrates that the human being is one part of a multi-layered web of both visible and invisible realities. Our understanding of the world is becoming less separate, less compartmentalized. Mind and body are both chemically inseparable. Thought and feeling both have intelligence. Our brains have become a new frontier. Yet we are humbled by how much more there is yet to discover. No longer do we live in a two-tiered universe where heaven is above and hell below. When we contemplate the universe, we see not only vastness beyond our imaginings, but a complexity of beauty that moves us to reverential awe. We no longer live in a universe where what is natural is separate from what is sacred and holy. Our respect and reverence for the complexity of life is ignited when we look into a microscope and we see the dance of atoms and parts of matter that are so incredibly small, no human eye can capture them. From these experiences, we know how truly interconnected we are, and our impulse toward the moral responsibility to care for this web of life is supported by both science and reverence. Reverend Murray says that becoming more fully human involves the transformation of the mind and the heart from self-centeredness into a sense of oneself as part of a larger sacred whole and to a deep commitment to the human and natural worlds. It's about the transformation from a shallow life of fear and greed, hedonism and materialism, to a meaningful life of love and joy, caring and gratitude, generosity, fairness and equity, hope and joy, and a profound respect for others. What was missing in the early development of humanism was the recognition of the human need for a religious experience of the natural universe and a reverential language to describe this ever-expanding reality. This is an edge for the humanism of the 21st century. In order to move in that direction, the humanism of the 21st century must include all aspects of the human experience. And this actually might be a very tall order. To me, this ever-expanding reality marries both the known and the unknown universe. It marries science and the imagination. It means using our total being to see the world. It means using our poetic or mystical perspective to see the world as one unified whole, radiant with meaning, and at the very same time seeing the world through our rational perspective, which means seeing everything in its discrete and separate parts. When we do this, seeing both simultaneously, I believe that we begin to approach seeing the true wholeness of the world. I believe we are getting closer to what reality is. We need, I think, to feel our human smallness in the face of immense unknowns. And at the same time, know through our reason that we are always on the edge of knowing. Some say that today we are on the edge, or possibly in the early stages, of another paradigm shift, affecting all areas of our life, our perception of ourselves, how we relate to each other, and how we relate to the universe. Perhaps we might call it religious meta-humanism, religious meta-humanism, a concept of human that transcends all dualities of thought and experience, that marry science and religion in ways yet unknown. The strength of religious humanism has been in its commitment to respond and adapt to new knowledge, and I believe this will continue. Our knowledge base is rapidly changing. Today, reason is but one measure of reality. Science itself has moved into a reality that encompasses both the knowable and the unknowable, hard fact and imagination, reason and reverence, which I will be speaking about in 2 weeks. Will religious humanism continue to grow and adapt in this new century? Will religious humanism today live up to its own 1933 self-definition as a religion for a free and universal society, a vital, fearless, and frank religion, a religion that must work increasingly for the joy in living? I leave you now with those questions.